It's good to have you back, Robert. This Outer Bridge Reach is such a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And I know you yourself were a Navy man, right?
Right.
So you probably drew on that quite a bit.
I drew on it. I was also a writer in residence at Annapolis for a period of time, this is the way the world is changing, for 2 years ago. So I was down at the Academy, and I was just sort of absorbing that, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I know. You have one scene set in Annapolis, and you describe the town pretty well. I wondered. I guess I thought you just kind of drove through it or something. Did you actually? You mean the midshipmen actually have writers and residences there?
Well, they do now, yeah.
I thought the literature was the last thing they studied at the Academy.
Well, it used to be. I mean, it used to be an engineering school entirely, but it's now possible to major in other things than marine engineering or engineering. You can be an English major now. You can be a history major.
Now, tell me about your naval background. This was, I know you were very young at the time.
I was 17 when I went in the Navy. I didn't finish high school. I had really sort of found myself at age 17 awash and with nothing really to do. And in those days, when you found yourself in that position, you went to the service. So I joined the Navy in August 55. On what is called a minority enlistment, also referred to as a kiddie cruise, and I got out when I was 21.
What did you learn while you were in the Navy?
I learned a lot. I think it did a great deal for my self-esteem. I really had been conducting this ongoing war with whatever there was, particularly with the school I went to, and in the Navy, it was really, I managed to feel as though I was doing something worthwhile, whether it was true or not. I really enjoyed being at sea. I did, in fact, see the world. I got down to the Antarctic, which is something I drew on for Outer Bridge Reach. I had a very pleasant time, all in all. It seems more and more pleasant as it gets farther and farther into the past.
You also did some learning, some academic type learning.
Well, I finished high school. I got a high school equivalency diploma from the Navy, and I learned a couple of phrases of various languages. The phrases that are most useful to sailors, which aren't necessarily the phrases that I would have occasion to use any time since. I think I learned a great deal. I grew up, anyway.
You say you went through Antarctica. There's in Outer Bridge Reach. There you really have some beautiful scenes set on that island. There's the one scene where Brown stumbles on to this whale graveyard, and you describe the bleached bones in the house. And did you actually encounter an island something like that?
Well, there are a number of islands, a great many, really south of latitude 50. I think what I used was not so much any one island, any one of the Antarctic islands. I think I was thinking of the landscape at Cape Hallet on the Pacific Ocean side of the Antarctic continent, the penguins, the landscape that's essentially black and white. The colors change according to the time of year. Somehow I think that landscape was somehow in my consciousness and stayed there. All this time, and I found myself able to draw on it for the novel.
Well, Outer Bridge Reach is about a lot of things, but central to the book, of course, is this worldwide sailboat race. Now, you must have had experience in small boats.
I had some experience in small boats. I had quite a lot of experience at sea. I didn't have so much experience sailing. I really set out when I began to write this, when I began to consider writing it, to do more sailing than I'd done. I'd sailed with people. Nothing very daunting. But when I started writing this, I began to crew for a man who charters out of the Hudson River in the summer and out of Charleville-Mali in the winter. I made a couple of trips with him. I really set out to learn what I could about hands-on marlin spike sailing.
The captain that you have crewed with, the same sort of boat?
A bigger boat. That was a 60-footer, two-masted catch. And the boat in the novel is a 40-foot single-masted sloop.
Which proves not to be as well constructed as everybody thought at the beginning. I guess the idea was to win the race, and then the company could sell a lot of these boats.
Well, that was the idea to begin with, and the company was unable to get the boat into production, even to have the design made that they originally intended. So they went to the Far East, and they had essentially a knockoff, a Far Eastern knockoff of the finished design done, and it was really not possible. It was not meant. This boat was really not meant to see to go to sea. It was a saving gesture on the part of the millionaire in the story, just to ward off a disaster. He went through with the manufacture of the boat, but he wasn't about to go to sea in it. He sort of left this there, and Owen Brown, who is a salesman of boats, a man who really doesn't know nearly as much about boats as he persuades himself he does, sells himself on the boat and gets himself into the race in this boat, which is really not serviceable for that kind of a passage.
There's so many terrific scenes out at sea. Tell me about the scene in which Brown and the boat are overrun by insects.
Well, there's a sequence, a chapter in which very close to the west coast, the northwest coast of Africa, one of the desert winds blows a cloud of locusts the way of the boat, and the sails and the rigging and the decks and the captain are all covered in these crawling insects. And this is a psychological blow of some devastation. It takes Brown a while to come back from this.
There's another terrific scene too, where Brown dives into the ocean, and as he's swimming to catch up back to the boat, he sees what he thinks is a cloud crossing the sun. What really happens there?
He's in the doldrums, and he reasons it's quite safe for him to trail a line behind the boat and go swimming, which is something that even single-handed sailors do in when becalmed. And while he's swimming for the line, this rogue gust of wind comes out of nowhere, picks up the boat, and the boat begins to rattle forward. And he has a panicky moment in which he has to swim for the line to hang on to it and pull himself aboard. And after he's laying on the deck, when he's finished swimming for a while, he looks overboard and he sees an enormous shark just shearing off a piece of the breathing world with the tip of its fin.
That's a great scene. He's all by himself for days, and he begins to hallucinate, and his whole life begins to change. Tell me what happens to a person like Brown in a situation like that.
Well, it's very common for people to hallucinate at sea. Many of the journals of the great single-handed sailors record hallucinations. Joshua Slocum, who, as far as we know, was the first man to sail single-handedly around the world, had elaborate hallucinations. He imagined that he was talking to Columbus's first mate, who this piratical figure with a bandana and a cutlass. Slocum records days of conversation with this apparition. So hallucinating at sea is not unusual. It's a little bit like when you're in the deep woods for long periods of time, you begin to see things. And of course, the sea is full of sounds, and the boat is full of sounds. And you're constantly listening to the sound of the wind, to the sounds of the boat. So it's one is prey to hallucinations at sea. And Brown, who is not used to this, who is thrown for the first time on his own inner resources, finds himself confronted with some old demons.
Well, at some point, he decides to abandon the race and try to fool. I don't know if I want to give away to this because it's toward the end of the book, but for our discussion at least, he begins to keep two separate logs, one a false log and the other the real log. What is his motivation for this?
Well, he keeps the false log, which is very stiff upper lip, very wall-eyed for publication. That's really meant to be his book when he wins the race and goes ashore. He's going to publish a book as many single-handed sailors do, and he thinks of this as a book that he wants to fit the mold. He's read all these single-handed narratives, and they tend to be high-hearted in the English style, and he's trying to imitate that kind of manly prose for publication. At the same time, he feels that his actual experiences, what he's actually feeling, might be worth recording too. So he begins to keep a second log in which he records the things that are really happening and the way he's actually feeling.
Well, there's so much high-tech equipment aboard that little boat. I had no idea. I mean, here is a satellite that can actually track it, and he gets faxes on board. This is real?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, weather faxes are quite common now. And boats carry a transponder, a device called a transponder, which receives and returns signals from a satellite. This is all a conventional part of deep water sailing now. In fact, it's even possible to with the position satellites, the positioning system satellites. There's something called SatNav that enables you to really press a button and you get your latitude and longitude in digital numbers, a readout. So technically speaking, I mean, although it wouldn't be wise, if as long as you were within the scope of the satellites, you wouldn't even really have to know how to use a sextant necessarily.
Yeah, and just to pick up the telephone and dial home.
Yeah, right, right. And that also is done. Ham operators usually cooperate with people at sea. They'll patch in a call to a telephone number. They'll send the signal to another ham, and the ham will connect with the other telephone. So it's quite commonly done also.
Boy, there's so much about the boat world. It's a world that I don't know anything about, but there's a scene in a boat, what do you call them, a boat fair?
A boat show.
Boat show, I guess. And all the dialogue, the people in the dock at Staten Island and this sort of thing, it sounds right. You must have really immersed yourself in this world. Huh?
I hung around, and I tried to make it right.
Do you have your own boat?
I don't. I haven't. I had a boat in common with a neighbor some years ago. He died, and it was too much boat for me. I sold it. So at the moment, I don't.
But you're very close to the water.
Very close to the water, on
it, I guess. Huh?
Right, right. On the Connecticut shore.
Would you have a place to berth a boat near where you live?
Well, we lost our space. I lost my space, my berthing space, when I gave up that boat. So it might be something of a problem. On the other hand, I might be able to use a friend's.
First, to write the way you do, for example, Children of Light, I know you've had Hollywood experience because you wrote two screenplays based on your own work, so you really got to know the people. And I guess to write any kind of book, you really have to, you can't just guess it. I mean, there are people who say to me, well, I'd like to write a novel because I can just make it up. But I'm not sure you can do that because there has to be a credible environment in a book.
I think in the realist mode, which I think is, and I think the Outer Bridge Reach falls within the parameters of realism, there's a certain responsibility to get it right, to get the level of, to render the world correctly, the world in which the novel is supposed to take place. I think you really have to know something about the world you're writing about just to have a right to an opinion, and I think certainly to write comfortably, to write convincingly, even for yourself, you have to know what you're writing about.
You ever get a letter from a reader saying, Mr. Stone, you've got this wrong?
I have gotten letters, and sometimes they've been wrong, and they just didn't like the way I got it, but sometimes they've been right, and I hadn't got it wrong.
Tell me the significance of the title, Outer Bridge Reach.
Outer Bridge Reach is a section of the channel between Staten Island and New Jersey. It's very close to the transfer station at Great Kills. It's close to the Bayonne Bridge. It's near Prawls Island, which is at once a kind of an industrial wasteland and also a bird refuge. I mean, where you see bird watching is really wonderful down there. You see all manner of seabirds and aquatic birds, but at the same time you're looking at a landscape of tank farms. So it's a very surreal place. It's a kind of condemned place. It's a frightening place. And it stands in the novel not only for itself, but also for a certain state of mind or state of soul.
Tell me about the jacket cover. It's really a fetching, looks like a woodcut.
It's Rockwell Kent. It's called Hail and Farewell. Yeah, I'm very fond of the cover.
Oh, it's beautiful. It shows a man, obviously a seaman, on a rope ladder, apparently climbing up the side of a ship.
Right. Standing in the shrouds. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said on the last occasion of your visit here that you were going to be stepping up your literary output. And I guess you certainly have, because you used to go something like 10 years between books.
Well, I never went 10. I did go 7, which is long enough. Life is short, art is long. I certainly do mean to step things up. It's easier said than done.
Do you find, after all of these years as a writer, that it gets harder or easier?
I really can't decide that from day to day. Sometimes I think, I mean, the way I feel now, I can't imagine ever doing this again. But on the other hand, I think you do learn a few tricks. If I can speak of the artist's method as tricks, I suppose they are. Sometimes it seems like it's getting harder. Sometimes it seems like it's getting easier.
You said tricks. Can you share a couple of those?
Well, I before E, except after C.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think these are hard to talk about. I mean, getting the dialogue right, hearing the sound, not indulging yourself, never thinking you're cute. I mean, being your own hardest critic. All those. I mean, those are all tricks of the trade. I think those are the important ones, anyway.
Do you read other people's work?
Oh yes. Yeah. I'm now reading short stories. I've just read 120 short stories by American writers. I'm editing Best American Short Stories, this year's collection.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That is certainly difficult, isn't it? And how do you decide what's best? You know, everything is so different.
Well, I really didn't know what to expect when I began to do it, but it proved easier than I thought, because some stories, you just feel them. They come at you. And you end up feeling them, and you end up thinking about them a lot, and those are the ones I'm picking.
You don't write short stories, do you?
I do. I'm working now on a book of stories. I have about 5 published short stories.
Uh-huh.
I had one of the New my most recent one was in the New Yorker,
uh-huh,
about a few years ago.
Uh-huh. Do you miss those merry prankster days?
Well, only to the extent that everybody misses the time when they were young and having a good time. I wouldn't have missed it. And I think back on it fondly. Yeah.
I was just talking to a woman who wrote or edited a book. I think it's called The Viking Portable Beat Reader. I was trying to figure out if the Merry Pranksters were part of the Beat Generation or not, and I don't think she was too clear on it. Maybe you could clear that up.
Well, there are a couple of there's an overlap in terms of personnel, principally Neil Cassady, who, of course, is a central character in Jack Kerouac's On the Road. He's represented in On the Road by a character named Dean Moriarty. Cassady, who was a great friend of Allen Ginsberg and of Kerouac, really was the main driver, I mean literally driver. He drove the bus when the bus went across the country in 1964, the Kesey bus. Neil Cassady was driving. Neil Cassady was very much part of the prankster scene. And there was a memorable party. One of the memorable parties of that decade, I think, was took place on Upper Madison Avenue in about 64, when the bus, that bus having been driven across the country by Cassady, arrived in New York. At this party were Kesey and all the gang, and also Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky, and a man who claimed to be Terry Southern but wasn't.
And were you there?
I was there. Yeah, I was there. It was not one of the great meetings. I think that Kerouac particularly had little use for us. Kerouac was then beginning to drink very heavily. He was not in a good humor. He didn't have much use for us. I mean, I can understand why. I think we probably looked to him like a bunch of suntanned California types. I think we looked a little bit like a Stanford fraternity party in a way, which was a little bit what we did look like. So this was an encounter between those core groups, the Beats and the Pranksters, in spite of having a common thread in Neil Cassady, I don't think there was a great deal of love generated between the two groups.
So the Pranksters were like new people coming on, right?
Yeah, I think the Pranksters were, in a way, the beginning of that what was going to lead to the kind of mass bohemia of youth in the late 60s. It was sort of things in a transition from being essentially an elite condition maintained by a few ardent spirits to something that was available to everybody under 30, as it was in the 60s. And now bohemia seems to have vanished and to have no proper existence anymore. I mean, I suppose the concept of avant-garde and the idea of opting out of embourgeoisement is so elusive now as to be meaningless.
Well, you mentioned this immortal bus ride. I have a feeling a lot of listeners don't know what you're talking about. Can you elucidate?
In 1964, the summer of 1964, Ken Kesey and a number of his friends, Neil Cassady, I can't remember everybody who was on the bus. I was not on it. I won't say I was never on it. I met it in New York. It parked in front of my apartment, and we drove around New York on it. But I was not one of the cross-country riders. But Ken and Neil Cassady, Ken Debs, others too numerous to mention, my friend Jane Burton, went by bus through the Southwest, stopping in Texas, New Orleans. I mean, it was really kind of an easy rider, proto-easy rider trip. This was, of course, 1964, which is a little bit before America was able to recognize and categorize what this phenomenon was, this strangely colored bus with all these oddly painted people in various conditions. So they drove it across the country, stopped in New York for a while. We had that party. And then they went back by way of the Calgary Stampede, back to California. That was the sort of something that Ken did after he finished Sometimes a Great Notion. It was his celebratory expedition.
Weren't the Merry Pranksters known for their experimentation with LSD?
They did have a reputation for that, yes.
There was so much partying and drugging and this sort of thing. How did anybody find time to write?
Well, it wasn't easy. I mean, I think you really had to not do it anymore in order to get anything done. You had to stop doing it and go off in the silence and the loneliness and the frustration and write, which so it's much more pleasant to party.
That's what you did, didn't you? You left California and came.
Yes, in fact, that's what I did. I left.
So it was just too much?
Well, I think I'd had enough. Maybe I'd had enough. I don't know. It's hard to recreate the way I was feeling then. I wanted to get my book finished. My wife wanted me to get my book finished. And between us, we left. And I got it finished. And then I went to Europe, and I sort of fell out of the scene a little bit. I was back from time to time. I was going between London and California at one point. And then in 71, I went to Vietnam. I was a nominal correspondent of a small English publication called Inc., I-N-K. And then the world changed. I mean, it changed, certainly changed for me, and I think it changed, in fact.
But I think it changed for you because also you developed a certain degree of maturity.
At the time, whether it was maturity or, you know, a failure of energy or a failure of nerve, I don't know. But I stopped doing it.
Well, the book that you referred to when you said I wanted to finish my book was Hall of Mirrors, which I read many years ago. It was a wonderful, wonderful book. And it took you a long time to get that out, didn't it?
Yes, I really began it probably about 1962. I hate to think about it, and it really wasn't published until 1967. It changed in my hands as I was writing it because, of course, things changed for me. I went into that scene, and my relationship with reality became a little bit more problematical, so that my mode of realism became more complicated. But, yes, it was a long time in the writing. It really was.
When you saw the finished product, Hall of Mirrors, and you were able to hold it in your hand, what feeling went through your mind?
Well, I was, in a way, surprised, because I think I'd thought that this was going to be the book that I was going to spend my life not writing. I knew a lot of people who'd done that, who had a book. They spent all their time ostensibly writing it, but what in fact they were doing was not writing it. And I kind of suspected that this was probably going to be me, that I was going to be 20 years on still trying to write this book. So I was surprised and relieved and pleased, also frightened at the prospect of now having this be no longer something between me and the kitchen table, but something that was going to be put before the world. In a way, I don't think I had actually expected that. I mean, I'd known it was supposed to be published, but I don't think I'd really reasoned out that lots and lots of people are going to read this book and form opinions about it. That was new.
That is kind of scary to create what you hope is a work of art and then hold it out to essentially an uncaring public. Because they don't care really whether you fail or succeed. They may like it or they may not like it. And what you've done, in effect, is spill your guts.
Yeah, they're there to be entertained, and the entertainment level is really all there is. I mean, you have to tell a good story. You have to entertain people, regardless of since. I mean, you get no points. You get nothing for sincerity. You have to tell the tale. You have to tell it well.
Well, certainly an Outer Bridge reach you have. I mean, there's a not only is the character development excellent because there are three primary characters, but there's a plot that moves. I mean, and you can right to the very end. In fact, even the even after Brown disappears, it doesn't stop. You mean, you think that the ending is an anticlimax, and I guess it is to a degree, but it just holds your interest to the very beginning. So it's a story with a definite plot. It seems to me, after thinking and maturing myself, that when you read a book, there has to be some, in a novel, a work of fiction, and even in a short story, there has to be some sort of major conflict that the character must overcome in some form.
Well, that's the classic old-fashioned mode, and I think it's a good one. I really tried in Outer Bridge Reach to tell a story that was exciting. I do believe in that. I believe in plot. I kind of enjoy it once I get into it. I enjoy foreshadowing and moving toward a destination. It gives a certain order and a shape to a novel. There are fine novels that really are anecdotal, but I really enjoy a fast-moving story.
Are you still teaching?
No, I'm not teaching at the moment. I have been excused from teaching because I have a grant from the American Academy, a five-year grant that where I get a small subsidy in exchange for devoting all my time to writing. So it's called a Harold and Mildred Strauss Living.
Oh, the Living Award, yeah.
And this has made a great deal of difference to me, and I'm a very grateful recipient of that award.
Now, that must be liberating, huh?
It really is.
Because even when you teach or have to teach, That's almost like a job.
Well, it is it's definitely moving in that direction, and you do want to, I mean, your currency is time in a way. You want all the time that you can command to write.
Well, in the past, when you were teaching, have your students come up to you and have they said something to the effect, "Professor Stone, tell me how to do it"?
Well, that's the one thing you can't do. I mean, I think I don't think anybody's ever put it in those terms, but perhaps people have come expecting that. But you can't really teach anybody to write. You can give people the experience of writing something, of investing their egos and their intellects in entertaining someone through the medium of words. You can give them that experience. You can take them seriously. You can give them the gift of being taken seriously. But the one thing you cannot do is impart a mechanics. You have nothing really to instruct them in, except to find out what they already know. That they must find out what they themselves already know and somehow write it. I mean, I think essentially it's a gift, and some have it and some don't, and those who do can be led to exploit it successfully. But I think those without it probably are not going to have it, regardless of any instruction.
You said it's a gift. I wonder why that is, why some people like yourself have this literary bent, and other people who are perfectly charming and intelligent just don't. Is it?
Well, it isn't a matter of intelligence, I know. In fact, I sometimes suspect it's probably not good to be too intelligent to be a writer. It's a certain relationship, I think, with language, besottedness with it, perhaps. I always remember being really taken with the old radio shows that I was a child in the great age of radio, and I remember those. I remember Sam Spade describing his adventures to us while they were taking place. The narrative really fascinated me. I just loved it. And, I don't know, I was always interested in words.
Well, to wrap things up a little bit, Robert, I was wondering maybe you could read a passage or two. Do you have any particular favorite passage you might like to read?
Well, I might read the passage that describes Outerbridge Reach itself.
Fine.
In a still backwater off the kill, ringed with lights like a prison yard, wooden tugs and ferries were scattered like a child's toy boats. Some lay half-submerged and gutted, their stacks and steam engines moldering beside them in the shallows. Others were piled on each other, four and five high, in dark masses that towered above the water. Brown knew the place. It was the property of his father-in-law, Jack Campbell. The wooden boats that rotted there, floodlit and girded round with electrified fence and razor wire, had been working harbor craft 80 and 90 years before. Brown's father-in-law, a Yale man, was the presiding chief of a race of water ruffians, Irish and Newfie by origin, who had lorded it over certain sections of dockland since the last century. Rich from rum-running, bootlegging, and two world wars, the Campbells owned odd lots of wharfage and real estate all over the harbor. Parsifal's port float ran up the hull plates of a decaying tug, raising the shriek of fiberglass on metal. Under the awful sound, Russ Colombo's seamless crooning sounded on. The tug lay so far over that Brown could step out onto her topsides. He threw a line around a bit of the tug's forecastle and secured it. Then he walked along the rust-flaked hull to the wheelhouse and hunkered down to look around him. Somewhere ashore, a dog began to bark. On Brown's left, the hulks lay scattered in a geometry of shadows. The busy shear and curve of their shapes and the perfect stillness of the water made them appear fast in some phantom disaster. Across the kill, bulbous storage tanks, generators, and floodlit power lines stretched to the edge of darkness. The place was marked on the charts as Outerbridge Reach. In the week after their wedding, Anne had brought him to the place as a joke. "This is what comes with me," she had said. "This is the family estate." "Well," he had said, "we need a picture." So they had taken a picture of Anne's brother Aidan in his racing coracle among the hulks. Sheltering from the wind against the pilot house bulkhead, Brown remembered the afternoon as though it were the day before. He laughed at finding himself there again. The tape ended and the marshes of Outerbridge Reach received the soil tide. He remembered scraps of the place's history. Thousands of immigrants had died there, in shanties, of cholera, in winter far from home. It had been a place of loneliness, violence, and terrible labor. It seemed to Brown that there was something about the channel he recognized but could not call to mind. On the dark shore, the junkyard hound kept barking as though it would go on forever.
Very, very nice. Outer Bridge Reach, new novel by Robert Stone. Beautiful job. Robert, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don.